This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Karl Rove, the Political Press Corps, and the Democratic Process. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The grand jury's still out on whether Karl Rove committed perjury, obstructed justice, or exposed a CIA agent. But Washington reporters are taking heat for protecting confidential White House sources when the real story should be the identity of a leaker. The media also are being questioned for playing down a Democratic report that Republican dirty tricks helped President Bush win Ohio last year. On To the Point, are reporters trading their independence for high-level access? Is Rove the master of media manipulation, or has he stumbled into uncharacteristic blunders? On Reporter's Notebook later on, supercomputers and national pride. First, the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Olney, back with To the Point. Karl Rove has been called a political genius and the master of media manipulation. On To the Point, have reporters traded their independence for access to the most powerful White House insider of all? We'll look at the stories of CIA agent Valerie Plame and last year's Ohio election. On Reporter's Notebook, the race is on to build the world's fastest supercomputers. We'll hear what's at stake for the United States. First, this news update. Two American Navy ships have left Jordan's port city of Aqaba after one of three rockets narrowly missed the USS Ashland, striking a warehouse and killing a Jordanian soldier. Another fell near a hospital a mile away, and a third hit near an airport inside the Israeli border. Steve Simon is author of The Age of Sacred Terror, and he's a senior policy analyst at RAND. Steve Simon, as always, welcome to our program.
Hi there.
A group called the Abdullah al-Assam Brigades has claimed responsibility for these rocket attacks. What do we know about them?
Well, we don't actually know a lot about them. Abdullah al-Assam was a mentor of bin Laden's. He was killed in a car bomb explosion, I think, in 1989. His name has been appropriated in claims of responsibility for two sets of previous attacks, both having taken place in Egypt, in Cairo, and at a beach resort in the Sinai Peninsula.
Those were fairly extensive attacks. You're talking about Sharm el-Sheikh, the recent one there?
Well, there were actually two in Taba or Sharm el-Sheikh, and I'm talking about the first set, not the one that just took place, but there was a prior set of attacks in that same area. And those who perpetrated that attack claimed responsibility under the name of the Abdullah al-Assam Brigade. There was also, a pair of nearly simultaneous attacks in Cairo before then that the perpetrators also identified themselves as members of the Abdullah al-Assam Brigade. But, it's not as though this is an organization that has, identity cards and a website and, a home office somewhere. This is simply a name, as far as anyone knows, that is used by people who carry out these attacks.
So you don't think, then, that this is likely the work of some sort of centralized organization that's planning and synchronizing attacks?
Well, if by that you mean an organization like al-Qaeda and its leaders who were holed up somewhere in Waziristan in Pakistan or Afghanistan, probably not. On the other hand, there is a fairly centralized network that's developed under the leadership of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the guy who is seems to be running a lot of the insurgent activity in Iraq. He is, of course, originally Jordanian himself, and it's possible that the people who carried out these attacks in Jordan were doing so in response to guidance provided by Zarqawi, but we really don't know.
Talking with Steve Simon, a policy analyst at RAND, author of The Age of Sacred Terror. What's the significance of the location of this? Up at the end of the Gulf of Aqaba, at the port of Aqaba, with one of the rockets coming out of Jordan and striking Israel.
Well, it's a, you know, it's a really rich location because the rocket attack is really aimed at three countries. The rocket attacks, I should say, are really aimed at three targets at once, which from the attacker's point of view is just great, very efficient. On the one hand, you attack the United States. On the other, you attack Israel. And on that third hand, you are in effect attacking Jordan. You're embarrassing the regime, the leadership in Jordan, and you're embarrassing their intelligence and law enforcement capability by carrying out the attack from Jordanian territory.
We don't hear very much about the U.S. Navy presence in that area. There was, of course, the attack on the USS Cole as well. But here are these two warships anchored there in the port of Aqaba. What are they doing there? And are they, like the presence of American troops on the Arabian Peninsula, the kind of presence that incites extremists?
Well, you know, these extremists, the ones we're talking about, don't need much incitement at this point. But there's no question that the U.S. vessels there are both a source of provocation as well as inspiration for an attack, a very nice target. They're part of the Fifth Fleet. The Fifth Fleet is our flotilla of naval vessels that patrols the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean in that area. They patrol the area fairly regularly, and they do make port calls in the region. In this case, the port call was to conduct training with their Jordanian naval counterparts.
Again, then, three rockets today fired from Jordan, one of them almost hitting one of the American ships. Those ships now have left the port of Aqaba. Steve Simon, again, thanks a lot for being with us.
You're most welcome.
Senior policy analyst at RAND. In a moment, Karl Rove, the Political Press Corps and the Democratic Process on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Orman Alney back with To the Point. Karl Rove and the rest of the political world are waiting for a Washington grand jury to make its report on who leaked the identity of a CIA agent. Also at issue in that story is whether protection of high-level sources is making reporters part of a White House cover-up. Meantime, in a story titled None Dare Call It Stolen, Harper's Magazine has revisited last year's presidential election in Ohio and accusations of Republican dirty tricks by Democrats in the Congress. The author is Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media studies at New York University. He concludes that news has become, quote, a daily paraphrase of Karl Rove's fevered dreams, and that the press corps has unilaterally disarmed. Mark Crispin Miller, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me on.
How'd you reach those conclusions?
Well, just by studying the Conyers report, which you alluded to a moment ago. This was a report put out by the Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee on January 5th. They had invited the Republicans on the committee to participate, but the Republicans boycotted it. It was timed for maximum impact just before the challenge to the electoral vote in Ohio on January 6th. This report is filled with evidence of widespread fraud in Ohio at every level before, on, and after Election Day. And people can read the report for themselves. It's been published as a paperback called What Went Wrong in Ohio. Anyway, I am writing, have a book coming out on the election and had, of course, read this report closely and was really appalled to discover, or rather to have my sense reconfirmed, that this report got no press whatsoever when it came out. It was as good as ignored. And considering the importance of the, you know, I'll call them allegations, but they're all documented and they're all, it's all sworn testimony and so on. I was just amazed in trying to find evidence of American coverage of this report at how little there was. I can't think of anything more important than the integrity of our electoral system. And it seems to me that on this very important issue, the press has failed in its duty.
Well, you say there was evidence. You also quote to some reporters, and I recall them myself at the time, and we did some reporting here on this program about that, saying that they really didn't think the evidence was very solid. And, of course, the Republicans attacked it as a Democratic effort to discredit the administration and the election. What do you think is the most important evidence in this case?
Well, there's so much that you know, I'm staggered at the question, but let me say that, for one example, before the election, Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell tried in many different ways, many of them overturned in court, but too late, to preempt the Democratic vote, to prevent Democratic voters from registering. The most dramatic thing that happened is that during the recount, which had been ordered by the court after Election Day, employees of a company called Triad, which manufactures the vote-counting tabulators that were used in Ohio and in Florida, employees of this company had gone out county to county basically to help the Republicans on the boards of elections make sure that there was no hand count in their jurisdiction. They were providing them with cheat sheets. And there was even testimony to this effect from an employee at Triad. On election night, Warren County suddenly threw out all the poll watchers and the press, claiming that there was a terrorist alert. Now, this is a rural county with a population somewhat less than that of Akron. The FBI denied issuing a terrorist report, and a week later it came out that the plan to do this, the plan to count the vote in secret, had actually been hatched 9 days ahead of time. They found emails to this effect, and the Cincinnati Inquirer reported it. Now, Warren was one of the last counties to have its votes tabulated, and it was clear that they were waiting to see what the state total was so that they could then adjust the numbers accordingly in order to give Bush his victory. Now, all this is in the Conyers report, and it's not just allegation. However, you are right in saying that the Republicans played it that way. I discussed this in None Dare Call It Stolen. The so-called congressional debate over this report, you would have a Democrat quote from the report, and then a Republican would stand up and give a series of talking points, basically attacking the Democrats for conspiracy theorizing, for trying to inhibit faith in the electoral system, for being destructive, for being part of the Michael Moore wing of the party. It was all ad hominem stuff. It never once specifically addressed any of the points in the Conyers report. Well, that's a comfortable position to take. We can just shrug this off. It's lunacy. Don't listen to it. It's crazy. And I'm afraid that the press responded to that line.
How do you connect Karl Rove? You said, as I quoted earlier, that the news has become a daily paraphrase of Karl Rove's fevered dreams. How does he figure into this situation?
Well, as I think you know, and as many know by now, thanks to the book and the movie of Bush's brain, which are both quite good, Rove in particular has a certain political genius for this kind of mischief. I don't mean to say that the entire theft of the election, which I regard as a national phenomenon, and I'll be talking about that in my own book, I don't mean to say that he was the sole author and executor of this plot, but I do think that given his past, given his penchant for a kind of highly sophisticated mischief, given the fact that he was basically drawn to politics by the Nixon regime and was kind of a young Nixonite as a college Republican, you could say that the last election has his big clammy handprints all over it.
Okay. Mark Crispin Miller, again, professor of media studies at NYU, author of None Dare Call It Stolen, the article in Harper's Magazine, current at Harper's Magazine. You mentioned Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential, both a book and now a film as well. Wayne Slater, one of the co-authors, familiar voice to our listeners, senior political reporter at the Dallas Morning News. Wayne Slater, as always, welcome to you.
Good to be with you, Warren.
You covered the election. You talked a lot to Karl Rove. Did he seem to know a lot about Ohio?
He knew a lot about Ohio. And in fact, I remember at one point we were actually in Florida, having left Ohio in the last 2 weeks of the election, and I confronted Rove at a ball field while Bush was making a speech and said, move him around by saying, I'm hearing very bad things. I'm hearing that the vote totals in Ohio are going to be against you because your registration effort there is bad. He fired back at me for 4 or 5 minutes, sort of chapter and verse, statistics, counties, precincts, people, numbers, an extraordinary real-time grasp of exactly what was going on, not only around Cuyahoga County, but around Cincinnati, Columbus, and elsewhere. And in retrospect, everything he was telling me was exactly right. He knew hour by hour what was going on in Ohio.
Well, what about Mark Crispin Miller's assertion that the press ignored the evidence in Ohio that was in the Conyers report? John Conyers, of course, a Michigan Democrat who was a senior member of the on the minority side of the Judiciary Committee, then walked away from what appeared to be, to him at least, an enormously important story. He says the press unilaterally disarmed.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure I'm here to defend. I'm not here to criticize Mark, who is a great reporter, and I look forward to the book, and I have read the Conyers report. It is a compelling piece of work. I think there is another side to this, and my sense is that a number of reporters were not necessarily lazy, but looked at this report and another one done by the Democrats and essentially said, you know, there's no absolute proof that this would have changed the election. The sort of feeling and dynamic at the time was, let's move on. And there may have been as many problems on Republican side. They may have lost votes in places like Wisconsin. And I'm not justifying their relative lack of reporting, although I frankly do remember some stories at the time. But I think that maybe there's absolutely no proof that this election would have gone another way. I'll hold judgment there until I read Mark's book, and that the reporting of it was probably pretty reasonable.
Did you report on it?
Nope. At that point, but I know our bureau did in Washington. Now, I'm back in Texas. I live in the real world, and I jumped off the plane, went back to where real people live, and it isn't a subject that I wrote about. I mean, Mark's right. I mean, everything he said is absolutely right. The substance of the Conyers report is compelling. It raises really dark questions. The coverage of it was not, I think, what someone might have expected. But in the end, I'm not sure that I'm not ready to give the entire media and the press corps an F on this.
Okay, Wayne Slater, again, author of Bush's Brain and senior political reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Back to Mark Crispin Miller. Again, his upcoming book is Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They Will Keep Doing It Unless We Stop Them. Back to your magazine piece, and None Dare Call It Stolen, and the issue here. John Conyers, the author of that report, lead author of that report, as I understand it, said himself that he didn't think that the problems that occurred in Ohio would have changed the outcome of the election.
Yeah, I asked him about that, in fact, and I don't know if it's in the article or not. I think it is. He told me that, you know, he certainly is convinced that it would have made an enormous difference, but he could not say that in heralding the appearance of the report, because he said he would never have gotten a hearing if he had dared to suggest that there was something about the election that was really demonstrably off. I think it's important to emphasize one thing here, and that is that attention must be paid to the 2004 election, not so that we can belatedly change the results. That's impossible constitutionally, and I'm not sure it's even such a good idea, even from the standpoint of the most, well, maybe a really diehard Democrat would feel that it's a good idea, but I don't think it would be. The point is not to go back and rehash the past. The point is indeed to move on. And it seems to me that what we have to do before we do anything else politically in this country is reform the electoral system. The need for electoral reform is severe. It's serious. What happened last time was, in fact, primarily on the Republican side. There was a little bit of small-time chicanery on the Democratic side. But the fact is the Republicans now control the process. It is not a Democratic process anymore. The only way to initiate the necessary national debate about the need for electoral reform is to allow the scandal of 2004 to resonate. And, you know, I think the world of Wayne Slater. I like his work, and I'm grateful for his gracious words a moment ago. But, I mean, if the press was going to look for absolute solid proof before, covering a story, how would he explain their readiness to credit the White House's line on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? There was no evidence for those at all. And the people at the time, the few who stood up and spoke out and said, look, this is a crock, like Scott Ritter, he was universally derided by the press. He was derided on CNN. He was derided in the Times and in the Washington Post. I mean, you know, let's face it. This is evidence that there's just too tight an embrace, okay, between the press and the government.
Let me interrupt you a moment because I want to get another voice in here before we have to go to a break. We've been joined by Carl Cannon, who's White House correspondent for the National Journal, also author of a book about Karl Rove, Boy Genius, Karl Rove, the brains behind the remarkable political triumph of George W. Bush. Wrote that in 2003. Carl Cannon, as always, welcome to you.
Hi, Warren.
We've been talking with Mark Crispin Miller and Wayne Slater about the Conyers report that came out in January, and Wayne Slater has conceded Mark Crispin Miller's point that given the compelling nature of the evidence presented and the dark questions that it raised about manipulation of the process, it got less coverage than it deserved. What do you think?
Well, Warren, this is not something I've looked into, which probably confirms that you're, you know, the criticism, but I just don't know. I cover the White House, you know, and I don't know about that. The 2004, I got a lot of those emails from the people in Ohio, and it was this, you know, sort of couched in conspiracy language. It was so anti, the people telling me were so anti-Bush and had been so even before. They were talking about fraud a year before the election. Maybe we didn't take them as seriously as we should have because they were so obviously partisan.
Do you think Karl Rove had anything to do with this? Did he lead reporters away from the story in some way? And might he have been responsible
in Ohio? I'm not going to – look, we ought to look into anything. I heard that gentleman say – I didn't catch his name, but he said we ought to look into things. Well, I agree with that, but Rove never discouraged me from looking into this, and I'm not even going to concede that there's yet. I don't know that there's any scandal in Ohio, but I don't. But if there was, yeah, I don't know if Rove had anything to do with it or not. I mean, the stuff I found him doing was all sort of things you want politicians doing, get out the vote stuff. That's what I know about what he did in Ohio.
Carl Cannon, again, the White House correspondent for the National Journal, author of Boy Genius, Karl Rove, the brains behind the remarkable political triumph of George W. Bush. Our other guest, Mark Crispin Miller, he is the man you referred to a moment ago, professor of media studies at NYU, and Wayne Slater, also with us, senior political reporter for the Dallas Morning News. We're going to continue with them and another guest as well in just a moment. On Reporter's Notebook a little later, we'll talk about supercomputers and national pride. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, to talk today about Karl Rove, the political press corps, the democratic process. We've talked a moment ago about an article in Harper's Magazine that is out this month, revisiting last year's presidential election in Ohio and saying that it provides evidence evidence that the press corps has unilaterally disarmed with regard to Karl Rove and made news a daily paraphrase of his fevered dreams. That's a quote from our guest, Mark Crispin Miller. I want to talk about another article now. The grand jury, of course, is still out on the question of whether Karl Rove was the White House insider who leaked the name of the CIA agent Valerie Plame. She, of course, the wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who had written in the New York Times that the Bush administration twisted intelligence to justify the war in Iraq. Well, in Vanity Fair magazine this month, there's a story entitled All Roads Lead to Rove, and it says that in reporting that story, the press corps in Washington has been part of a cover-up. Michael Wolff wrote that one, and Michael Wolff, welcome to you.
How are you?
How did the press cover up?
Well, they didn't tell the story. They knew the story. More than anybody, they knew exactly what happened nearly 2 years ago, and they didn't print it. They didn't tell us.
What happened that they didn't tell us?
Well, they didn't tell us that Karl Rove was in fact the source of the Valerie Plame outing. They did not tell us that he spoke to reporters. They did not tell us that actually when Karl Rove said he didn't have anything to do with it, that he in fact did have something to do with it. They didn't tell us that when the president said if any members of my administration were involved with this, they will be fired. They didn't tell us that it was Karl Rove who was involved, and therefore Karl Rove who would have been fired.
Are you absolutely certain? Is there concrete evidence publicly that we know now that Karl Rove was in fact the source?
Yeah, of course. There was the email from Matt Cooper has been widely distributed.
He, of course, the Time magazine correspondent who did not have to go to jail because his editors made available to the grand jury and the special prosecutor the information they had asked for. But what specifically in that email from Matt Cooper do you think makes it very clear that Karl Rove was the source?
Well, that's because Cooper says, I just spoke to Rove, I think Cooper calls him my double secret something or other source, and this is what Rove said. So now, whether it is actually, he actually violates the law, we don't know. I mean, that's obviously for the grand jury to ultimately decide, but what we do know is that he did something which he publicly denied doing, that is talking to a reporter about Valerie Plame and Joe Wilson, number one. And we also know that the president said that if anybody in his administration had done that, precisely that, talked to a reporter about Valerie Plame, he would be fired. So that's what we know.
And when you use that phrase in Mark Cooper's email to his editors about a double secret background or whatever it was, I presume also you're referring there indirectly at least to the stand that so many reporters have taken, that they cannot reveal a source, that they will go to jail, in fact, before they do that.
Right, exactly.
And is that improper conduct? Is that something then that makes them part of the cover-up?
Yeah, well, in this instance, it does. I mean, listen, I've been a journalist all my life, and obviously sources are important, and obviously confidentiality is important. But there are cases, and there are cases. And in this case, we have one of those very clear instances where you got to stand back and say, hey, maybe we're being a little too literal about this. And very clearly what happened here is that the source became the story. That's the big story. The big story is that Karl Rove was the double secret blah, blah source. And these reporters in these news organizations essentially said, well, we're going to protect our own business interests, that is to say our relationship with the source, over that's more important than getting this really big story out there.
Michael Wolff, columnist for Vanity Fair, a column called All Roads Lead to Rove. Let me go back to Carl Cannon, our White House correspondent for the National Journal, again has co-authored Boy Genius, Karl Rove, a book about Karl Rove and the triumph of George W. Bush. What do you say, Carl Cannon, to what we just heard from Michael Wolff?
Well, I can't disagree with much of it, but I would disagree with the The last thing, the conclusion, I don't think it's very clear that this is an instance where these guys should have turned on their source. I think he's right that they must have felt that they had been compromised. And remember, he used the pronoun they, and I just used it. You know, I cover the White House. I didn't know Karl Rove was a source. We're talking about one columnist, Bob Novak, who does not cover the White House, and a writer, Matt Cooper, who had been Deputy Bureau Chief of Time and had been replaced and sent back to the White House and had been there, I think, a few weeks when he started doing this. So, I mean, we're not talking about the White House press corps. We're talking about two individuals. And the question is, should they have outed their own source when the story turned the way it did? Michael thinks that they should have. Geneva Overhauser, I have trouble pronouncing her name, Michael Kinsley. There were a couple of people who said this at the time. I don't know if I agree with that. You know, I'd like to hear Michael say why. You know, how do you know how the story is going to turn out, and can you really be selective then when you're going to honor your word? That's sort of the dilemma here.
Michael Wolff, back to you.
Yeah, we have. I mean, here are the responsibilities. One does have a responsibility to one's source, but one has a greater responsibility to one's readers. And this is what a journalist can't do. And if a journalist does do it, he ought to be fired for cause on the spot. He cannot sit on a story. And this was one of those cases where it suddenly developed that the source was the story. And, you know, maybe everyone wishes it hadn't gone that way, and maybe everyone wishes that they could be as honorable as they said, that they could keep their word, that they could keep everybody happy, but they can't. And in this instance, as a reader, I am really unhappy because these news organizations knew it. They knew that a crime had potentially occurred as close to the President of the United States as it could possibly have occurred, and they didn't print that story. And for that, again, I will, on no uncertain terms, I would say you're fired.
So what then, Carl Cannon, about the balance we're talking about here? On the one hand, you have, as Michael Wolff just said, a potential crime very close to the president, and the president himself saying, I'll fire anybody who had anything to do with this.
Yeah.
And then people apparently knowing, in fact, who the leaker was to the most powerful guy in Washington.
Well, Warren, Matt Cooper knew it. And to take Michael's a thoughtful critic, but to take what he's saying literally, who would have fired whom? The only people who knew that Matt Cooper had talked to Karl Rove were Matt Cooper's editors, the ones that weren't sitting on. I mean, Cooper wasn't hiding this from his editors. Why would they fire him? I mean, you've got a thing here where, go back to this story, how it unraveled. Time's first story, Matt Cooper wrote a story on their website basically turning on his sources. He said the White House, you know, this war against Joe Wilson. So we knew that high-ranking White House officials had targeted Wilson, and in fact we knew why, because Wilson had targeted them and called Bush a liar and Cheney a liar in the New York Times. So the context is this fight was going on. The single fact we didn't know, and in fact Rove's name was in the paper thanks to Joe Wilson, speculative. What we didn't know was that it was Rove. And I think what Michael's saying is that when we asked, and we did not ask about this, we asked Scott McClellan about this, not once, but I think two or three times, and he said it was totally ridiculous. And I think what Michael's saying is that at that point, the reporter, the original deal with the source has got to be by the boards, because the thing has entered another level. You've got the White House spokesman lying in public there, or not lying, I don't know what Scott knew, but saying something that they know to be false. He's saying at that point they are relieved of their obligation to protect Rove, and I'm just not sure I agree, but I get the point. But I'm not sure it's that easy because of the precedent that would set, that nobody would trust us again.
Carl Cannon with the National Journal. Michael Wolff, let me ask you the broader question raised earlier by Mark Crispin Miller, who was on the first part of our program, and that is this. Does this illustrate that the press corps is, in fact, too cozy with its sources, too close to the people who give it access and provide competitive advantages to some reporters and not to others and all the rest of that? Is this an illustration of that?
Well, it is an illustration of that. How broad, um, how broad this is, I don't know. I mean, I think it's important to not to generalize too far. And one of the things that I'm saying about this particular case is in fact it's become part of this greater generalization about the press and government and sources and reporters, and when in fact it's a very, very unique case. You know, I can think of many, many, many instances in which somebody a reporter should go to jail to protect his source. In this instance, what I'm arguing is that those conventions are not germane. The paradigm changed here, and the comment before about who should have fired who. The Matt Cooper's editors should have fired him, and Judy Miller's editors should have fired her. If in the instance when they said, you know, this is a story, you know, you've got the story, and you gotta write it. You can't sit on it. It's our job as a news organization to tell what we know.
What about Bob Novak?
Well, I'm not sure Bob Novak actually works for anyone. Bob Novak thing is, I mean, Bob Novak himself is such a strange creature I definitely think he should have been fired, but I'm not sure who would have fired him.
Bob Novak, of course, the columnist who originally printed Valerie Plame's name. He does have a syndicated column, I believe, with one of the Chicago papers, and he also works for CNN.
You know, the interesting thing about that guy is why couldn't he have at least said that he had spoken to the grand jury? One of the other things about this whole story is that everybody is kind of leaves a bad taste in your mouth. I mean, nobody really comes off as a straight shooter here.
Back to Mark Crispin Miller, from the earlier part of our program, again, professor of media studies at New York University. You made a fairly broad statement about the press earlier, and you said in your article that you thought it had become unilaterally disarmed, particularly by Karl Rove. Do you think that this is a unique story, the Valerie Plame story, or does the situation in Ohio and other things as well also serve to illustrate that the press and the news sources are too close?
I have no qualms about generalizing, to use Mike's word. I would call it, however, not a generalization, just an observation. We're coming at a major crisis in this country's history. We're coming at it piecemeal here. We're talking about a couple of examples of a trend that has been really problematic for years now. I mean, nobody was so careful about the sources that were used to impugn Clinton's character and his sex life. And I'm not saying Clinton shouldn't have been the object of critical news coverage. He certainly should have, but, you know, not this petty personal stuff. All the stuff about Clinton was unchecked, was hearsay, it was rumor mongering, and all of a sudden, nobody's concerned about the kind of meticulous checking that Carl Cannon mentioned a moment ago. Now, with Plamegate and with the election story last year, you got two huge examples of what we're talking about. The Downing Street memos, that's another very, very big story that should be covered. There are trivial stories that were killed at the last minute. There was all that speculation about that weird protuberance on Bush's back during his first debate with Kerry. The New York Times, according to Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, actually found an on-the-record witness who said outright that this was, in fact, a listening device that Bush was wearing so that they could feed him, Karl Rove, no doubt, could feed him lines. The day before the election, the story was killed because it was too controversial. Now, this is, you know, I'm troubled when I hear an important reporter say, we asked Scott McClellan about it, and he said it was totally ridiculous. This is not how the press should operate in a democracy. This is not what the framers foresaw. They should be a much more skeptical and antagonistic relationship because, as Michael said a moment ago, the press in this system is supposed to be serving us. That's the only reason why they enjoy First Amendment protection. They're supposed to be serving us. And if they shy away from unpleasant truths for business reasons, career reasons, fear, personal reasons, they have failed to honor the vision of the framers.
Okay, let me go back to Karl Cannon again at White House for the National Journal. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't even know where to begin. But basically, let's just start with the little thing he said about me. I didn't say that because McClellan said it was totally ridiculous that we shouldn't pursue it. What I said was I was saying that when he says that, that's probably that according to the Michael Wolff theory and the theory of Kinsley and people, that may be what obligates Time to break their deal. And I didn't say I was unsympathetic to that. I just said I didn't think it was clear. I thought it was a very tough call. So, I mean, I don't like my words being twisted around like that. But the point is that when you get a president, you know, that one side doesn't like, the liberals don't like Bush and haven't, and they think he's an idiot, you know, the question is, well, how did he get there? And it's the press. They're not doing their job. And, you know, we've been hearing this now for 5 years, but I would like, since the good professor invoked Clinton, I would like him to acknowledge that we heard all that stuff from the conservatives for 8 years about Clinton. We weren't doing our job. That's why he's there. We were covering up this, that, and the other thing. You know, I've covered the White House now 12 years. My father covered the White House, Warren. You know him. You know, most of the people there go over there every damn day and try and get the truth and try it. And you got to jackhammer out of these people, and it's hard to do. And to have somebody sitting up, you know, in New York and question our motives and our ethics and our integrity and our work ethic and all the rest of it, you know, it doesn't sit real well. I'll be honest with you.
Carl Cannon of the National Journal. Mark Crispin Miller, we've only got a couple of seconds left, but let me give you an opportunity to respond.
Well, I seem to have gotten his knickers in a twist. The point is that it's frequently the case, and I can cite many examples of reporters who basically accept an official denial and leave it at that. Now, what I don't like is being basically written off as a partisan lunatic in New York. I'm not a Democrat, for one thing, and I don't dislike Bush because he's a conservative. I don't think he is a conservative. I'm interested in the truth of the matter, and I expect the press to help provide me with the truth, whether I'm in New York or wherever else I am. I'm actually from Illinois. So this, you know, is actually an interesting example of the kind of tactic that the right uses, which is to turn on the person who's making the criticism and to characterize him in a certain way so that people won't believe what he's saying.
Okay, this is getting very personal. Carl Cannon, quickly back to you. Is there any legitimacy to the claim that sources and reporters in Washington are part of the same sort of overall society, if that's the right term, and is it something you have to worry about?
Well, of course, and let's look at it a little more specifically. We've had all this media consolidation, and nobody I know thinks that's a good thing, Warren. It's happening. You know, we're moving in two different directions at one time. We got these bloggers, and you know, the blogs tend to be ideological. You got the left wing blogosphere and the right wing blogosphere, but they do some pretty good work, and they've got a new model. And the new model is, you know, the old model was here, you know, from on high, Cronkite. You know, we know something you don't. Here it is. Take it or leave it. The new model is, hey, we think we know something. We're going to throw it out here. We want you to comment on it. That is small d democracy at its best. And so we've got that going on. At the same time, we've got all these corporations buying up each other and fewer outlets and news. And so the people at the White House, what you're seeing at the White House, Warren, I'll try and be quick, is this sort of consolidation, fewer outlets, fewer people. And you know, journalism professors, wherever they're from, Illinois or New York, look at this, and they're skeptical that it's going to work. And that's a skepticism I share.
Very quickly, Wayne Slater, back to you. I haven't heard from you for a long time. Bush's brain with the Dallas Morning News. Is this something that Karl Rove takes advantage of, what we're talking about, what Carl Cannon just mentioned?
You betcha he does. And we don't really have time to go into it, but I can name three or four episodes, certainly in my experience with Carl, where he attempts to intimidate other reporters by suggesting that I won't be your source, or in some cases I've had reporters come in asking me, national reporters, early on to ask questions of this Bush candidate for president back in 1999 because they were fearful of getting off on the wrong foot with the man who could be the future president. It's a concern. I think Carl is exactly right. It's the kind of relationship that, on the one hand, it should be designed to get the most information out there, and sometimes is misused and exploited by people like Rove.
Okay. A lot of issues raised today. Thanks, all of you, for being with us. Wayne Slater with the Dallas Morning News, author of Bush's Brain. Carl Cannon with the National Journal, author of Boy Genius, Carl Rove. Michael Wolff, columnist for Vanity Fair, current column All Roads Lead to Rove. And Mark Crispin Miller, author of a book upcoming, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Keep Doing It Unless We Stop Them. Thanks, all of you, very much for being with us today. Today's New York Times reports there's a global race underway to build the world's fastest supercomputer capable of 1,000 trillion operations a second, if you can get your mind around that. The latest competitor in the race is China. In a moment, we'll hear what's at stake for national defense, commercial manufacturing, and national pride on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Herman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Jack Dungara is a computer scientist at the University of Tennessee. One of the things he does is maintain a list of the world's fastest computers. Professor, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Warren.
Why does it matter?
Well, these machines, these computers, these high-performance computers are used for a number of very critical things, very strategic in terms of things going on within our country and other countries.
Can you be specific? For example, I understand the fastest one in the world now is at the radiation laboratory at Livermore in California, where they design nuclear weapons. Is national defense the principal thing they're used for?
Well, traditionally it has been. The defense industry has been the major consumer of these high-performance machines. The machines certainly at the top of this list of the fastest machines have been purchased for defense-related things. But they do, of course, have other purposes. They can be used for things like climate modeling, weather prediction. They could be used for things like airline scheduling, automobile design. They have really a multitude of ways in which they can be put to use for very productive purposes.
Let's talk a bit about how fast they actually work. It's my understanding that the world's fastest, the one in Livermore, has reached 136 trillion operations per second. That's 100,000 times faster than the latest desktop PC. What does that mean? I think these are numbers very few people can begin to understand.
So it's hard to get your hands around these numbers in some sense, but think of it like this. These computers are used to solve some of the most challenging problems that we have today. They're actually used in some sense like a crystal ball. They're able to predict certain things that are going to happen in the future. By putting in mathematical equations, by putting in a certain amount of physics or chemistry, and using these computers to drive the mathematical equations, we can get our hands around how things will evolve given certain events. An example is the Challenger event that just happened recently. There we wanted to model and understand exactly what happened as the foam fell off of the tanks and hit the wing of the aircraft, and we were able to do that pretty successfully on a high-performance machine and look at that event and understand better what happened, unfortunately, after the event had happened.
Is it difficult to program computers that work so fast?
Well, these machines, you have to understand, have what's called parallel processing. They use a number of different computers that have to be orchestrated simultaneously to help solve problems. The machine at Livermore, this fastest machine, today it has 64,000 processors. So now think about a person who has to program or orchestrate the computation that's going to take place and coordinate those 64,000 processors in solving a given problem. So it can be a very difficult problem indeed.
We hear so much about how this kind of thing is miniaturized and how everything now is on a chip that used to take up an entire room. You're saying, though, with 64,000 processors, that must take up a lot of space.
It takes up a lot of space indeed. In fact, there's an enormous room on the order of about a half of a football field that's there, which houses this machine. Not only does it take up a lot of space, but as you might guess, it consumes a lot of energy in terms of the power necessary to make this machine work. And that's becoming a very critical thing, is the heat generated by these machines and the power consumed.
Who else besides the United States has computers of this order of operation?
Well, almost every major country has invested somewhat in these machines. The U.S. certainly does have a large number. In fact, they have the majority of machines of this kind. But countries such as China, Japan, Europe, the European countries, India, Russia, sort of all of the developing countries have these computers and use them in some way to help with industry, with their defense programs. with their academic settings.
There is some criticism abroad coming from, among other places, the National Science Foundation, to the effect that they're used too much for defense. They could be used much more effectively and with much greater benefit to the human species if they were used more for science. What do you think about that?
Well, there's always a struggle here in terms of how these tools should be used and to what extent they should be deployed in the academic setting and have them deployed within the defense setting. There's always going to be a struggle as to which problems are the most important problems that we have to face. You should think of these computers sort of like the Hubble telescope in some sense, a very specialized piece of equipment that people are going to use to advance science at some level. And now we have to make decisions about what science is the most important and then give those users the ability to explore that on this piece of equipment. So it really is that kind of a device that we're talking about at the high end, these high-performance machines with hundreds of thousands of processors capable of attacking and solving some of our most challenging problems. And decisions have to be made on which problems are the most important.
And why, other than national pride, is it important for any given country to be able to say it has the fastest?
Well, these things can be used for issues of national security, certainly. So countries need to have the best machines for these purposes. In the case of in the U.S., we use them for ensuring our nuclear stockpile. We use them in terms of doing cryptography. We use them in industry and so on. And having the ability to manufacture and to use them locally is critical for those needs, or people feel it is critical for those needs.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Warren.
Jack Dungara, computer scientist at the University of Tennessee. Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Katie Cooper, Christian Bordahl, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, and Sherman Rembaum. Managing producer Cameron Radziner. Special thanks to Jennifer Sun and Charisse Williams. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Mormon Almy. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.